Hey, listener, welcome to episode number 107 of Blissen Up. If you've ever felt like life threw you a curveball that you did not sign up for, a diagnosis, a layoff, a pivot you didn't see coming, this conversation is for you. My guest today is Jeff Budd. He is the founder of Apocalypse Barbecue and the creative force behind some of the most talked about hospitality concepts coming out of Miami. He calls himself a professional problem collector. And once you hear him talk, you'll understand why. Jeff's whole philosophy is to make people feel something because the details matter to him and people feel them. You feel that the second you walk into one of his very popular restaurants here in Miami, and you're going to feel it when you listen to this interview. But the reason that I am most excited about sharing this interview with you is because the conversation isn't about barbecue. It is about how you reimagine your life and how you show up for your life when life throws you something you didn't sign up for. And maybe more than once. I can't wait for you to meet my dear friend, Jeff Budd, and let's dive in.
Listen up, people. That's right. It's time to listen to the sparks of bliss in your life. I'm your host and life coach, Caroline De Posada from Miami, Florida. And this podcast is an invitation to join me in upgrading our mindset, wellness, and relationships so that together we create a life that unlocks our bliss. Join me each week as we explore practical strategies, inspiring stories, and the moments of clarity, or as we like to call them, los momenticos, that make the world a little more magical. Consider this your weekly dose of wisdom in your pocket. Are you ready? Let's do this.
Hi, Jeff. I'm so excited to have you here.
Hi, I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Blissen Up podcast.
This is amazing. So where exciting.
Learn how to find the bliss in our lives.
I love bliss. This is great. We need to find some of that. Let's go.
Let's go. I am so excited to have you on this podcast. And I'm so excited about how we met. You are a great friend of my husband's.
Yes.
And it's because you have fallen into a little bit of a love affair with a certain collection.
I wonder if it's a love affair. I think there's a little, it's a love-hate relationship for sure. I love the watches. I hate, you know, the investments that go with them, but it's not terrible. But yeah, we started bonding over our love of timepieces, and it's been very cool.
And you guys have formed such a beautiful friendship. I had him on the podcast recently, and he was talking about how much he cherishes these friendships that he's formed as a result of this watch club. So I'm just so grateful that you guys have formed such a beautiful relationship.
Yeah, it is definitely one of those like unexpected things in life. I didn't go into this. I actually almost didn't go into this at all, because when they told me about the watch club, I thought that was a really corny idea. And I was like, dude, I'm not going to hang out with a bunch of dudes to talk about watches. Like, I have a job. This is crazy. And, you know, I ended up doing it. And I in my wildest dreams that I think that we would make a group of guys that not just hang out, right? But, you know, it's almost like therapeutic to be with each other. We talk about so many of life's crazy issues. And as I'm about to become a father, it has been such an incredible resource and comfort to be able to talk to these wonderful people that have been down this road, that have experienced all the things that I'm about to experience, and to be able to pick their brains and to ask questions and not feel like, you know, as a dude, there's that stigma of, I don't want to talk about things. And to be around people that are open to talking about things and open to discussing, it's definitely very assuring and very cool to have.
You know, what I love about that is I'm a huge proponent of community. Mm-hmm. And I curate communities. That's one of the things that I do, is curating communities of like-minded people who are looking to improve their mindset, their wellness, their relationships. And you guys have formed that kind of community.
Yeah.
Very like-minded. You all have very intentional lives and very focused, and you all prioritize a lot of the same things. And I'm just so impressed by those relationships. I remember you and I talked about a while ago, and I think that's probably why this community has been such a great fit for you, is you are a huge lover of finding mentors.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about that. I mean, when did you learn the cheat code that it is to find a mentor in your life?
Oof, that's a good question. I think early on, actually, I think I have the answer for that. When I was in high school, I knew I wanted to do something cool with my life, and I wanted to be some sort of business owner. Or like, you know, in my head, I wanted to be driving around in a super nice car with wads of cash everywhere, and I wanted to be balling. And I was like, how do I get to that stage, right? Like, how do I do that?
Wads of cash.
Yeah, just wads of cash and like duffel bags and just like cool cars with like dope rims that spins. At the time, that was like super hot.
You know that one day, one of our kids, maybe your kid, is going to watch this interview and go, what's cash?
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. I know. I actually just eliminated all cash at my restaurants officially. Wow. So it's pretty wild. We're going down that road. Wow. It's crazy.
Okay, so you were saying-
Yeah, I had these ideas, and I had no idea what I was going to do. And at the time, I was, you know, I was like 13, 14. I was living with my mom. And we had a neighbor, and he was getting really big into like SEO. I had no idea what SEO was, but he said he was making a ton of money, and he was like doing all these cool things. And so I asked him to teach me. And so we sat in his house, and we'd open up computers, and he was like, well, what's something you're passionate about? And at the time, it was cars with cool rims. And so he was like, well, let's make a website where you kind of like an eBay of rims, right? eBay wasn't like that big of a thing at the time. And he's like, we're going to make a website where people can go and sell rims. And so he taught me how to like code and do all this stuff. And we would spend a lot of time hanging out, and not just necessarily working on the website, but just like me asking him questions about growing a business and things like that. And I think that was
the first. How old was he at the time?
He was, well, that's a tough question to answer, because when you're young, you think everyone's way older than they are.
That's true. But he was like in his young 20s or like 30s?
I'd say he was probably in his 30s. Probably okay. Like probably my age now, like 35-ish, 38. I'm 38. So probably yeah. Around then.
So old enough where he had experience. Like you looked at this guy and you respected him. You admired
yeah.
him.
Yeah. Well, I thought I did, right? Like at the time, that was why he was the first kind of successful business person that ever spoke to me. And so it was really cool that he also went on a whim, and like, not that he invested a ton of money, but you know, he paid for .com and he invested in software, and he was like, yo, let's do this together. It was almost like a joint venture. He's like, I'll help you kind of create this thing.
So he saw something in you.
Yeah. He saw an opportunity to work together, and maybe for him, it was like, yo, here's this young kid that is probably going to have different ideas than me. I see that now a lot. As I talk to my teams, you know, there's this generation that's taking over the world next. They're so different from us, right? Their music is just night and day. It's almost a different language. Like their taste in art is different. The way they dress is different. Like everything has changed so quickly that it's almost like, yo, we don't really know what's going on anymore. And so I think it's important when you think of like your business and your brands and stuff like that, you need youth to stay relevant, because you need to be able to touch base with what they're into nowadays, which is mm-hmm. different than what we were into as kids. And a simple example of that, right? Like I don't wear socks where you can't see my socks ever. And like every friend I have who has a kid that's 15 plus is like, dude, like you can see your skin. That's gross. Like, what do you do? And I'm like, bro, what? Like you used to get roasted for having long socks. Yeah.
You can see my socks.
But so that's cool. You're cool. The longer the sock, apparently, the cooler you are now. Like,
yes.
And I don't get that.
Notice that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a weird thing. And you used to get cooked alive for wearing long socks when I was a kid.
True.
You know, so it's a thing. Baggy pants are back. I don't know when that happened. Like, you know, we had super tight jeans. They looked like they were spray painted on. And now kids are wearing pants that you can stick like an entire Coca-Cola bottle in there.
Well, you know what that also tells me is if you just hang in there, you being uncool will eventually turn cool.
Yes, it's facts. It's facts.
Like you could be as geeky or dress as baggy or as you want, and one day it's going to come back into fashion.
It'll come back into style. So funny enough, actually, you just said that, and it reminds me of another mentor I had later on in life. His name was Ramiro. We were having a conversation very similarly, and he pointed out, he's like, you know, when I was young, I'd look at my mom's wedding album and like her photo albums, and I'd be like, everybody looks like such a dork. And he's like, and now I look at her stuff, and I'm like, dude, all their clothes was really cool. And I'm like, yeah, man, like things come back in a swing.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So this was like the first time that you ventured into entrepreneurship was with this guy. And then how did that pan out? I mean, did you drop out of school and just keep working?
No, I didn't drop out of school. It didn't. I think it was a little bit early for me to kind of really take that seriously. I started hanging out with him and I tried learning about it. And, you know, at the time there was also other priorities in life, like going to parties. So that, you know, I wasn't 100% laser focused. And so I learned a little bit, and I think that was my introduction into not necessarily wanting to have like a 9-to-5 kind of gig and life. And that kind of proved itself when I graduated high school. I got into banking. I worked at SunTrust Bank. It was my first real job. Oh, wow. And I was a teller for a while, and it was cool, but not really for me. And then I transitioned to Bank of America, and I actually was climbing. I was doing pretty good. I went from a teller to a loan officer, and I did that for a while. And then a part of me started feeling like the tie around my neck was more of like a collar, and it was like holding me back. And I didn't want anything to do with it. And I was like, I need to figure something out. And that's when I kind of started venturing out again, looking for different opportunities, looking to get a little bit creative. And I was like, well, I didn't know which way I was going to land. And then I met another big influence in my life. I ended up getting a job at Apple. It was my first retail job at Apple. Mm. And that's where I met a dude named Brian Smith. And I met a lot of really, really cool people there. But Brian was probably, if I had to say, like my first big influence, like the first person to really put a fingerprint on my soul, would probably be him.
Really? Why?
There was, in the beginning, it was just something about, like, I'd watch him speak and I'd be like he could command a room, and he really managed to kind of inspire you in a very unique way. And I think he was part of like a group of guys that had kind of come up together. There was another manager named Steve and another one named George, and they each had different stores. Steve was in Aventura, George was in the Falls. And the three of those guys, especially Brian and Steve, the three of those guys, though, like they would really do these incredible. We had this training called Core at Apple, where you would bring the entire South Florida team and all the different retail stores, and we would learn together like what it meant to work at Apple, the steps of service, and all that stuff. And when those guys would drive it, everybody was just glued to them, and it didn't feel like you were at a corporate. You know, if anybody's done a corporate training, they're boring.
Yeah,
and it did not. It was not that at all.
So I'm a huge fan of finding synchronicities in life, like just little sparks that tell you, man, you're in alignment with what you're doing right now. One of my signature frameworks is called Core.
Okay.
So I think it's very cool that, you know, that you just mentioned that for the Apple thing, that there's a little synchronicity between you and me.
There you go. Oh, yeah. I love it. And so Brian, he became kind of a big friend and a mentor, and we would talk, and it was really just a lot of like kind of watching him and then learning about his decision making process and how he would question things. You know, he brought the competencies, the Lominger competencies. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
No.
So he brought that into my life. It was something that he would use to kind of guide his leadership team. And it was just 72, I believe it was, core competencies that define different characteristics or different attributes that helped shape a person. And they were really great as leadership tools. And okay. So one of them, for example, was dealing with ambiguity, right? And it was, we worked at Apple. You worked in a company where you didn't really know what was going on. It was big on secrecy. Everything was kind of in the dark. And oftentimes in retail, especially if you were doing a product launch, you wouldn't learn about the product until that morning. Like, we had no insight, no pre-training. Like, there was no, when the iPhone came out, there was no like, here's 3 weeks to play with the iPhone. It was, the iPhone's going on sale Tuesday morning, 15 minutes before we open, you can see the iPhone. And
do
so
you like that?
I learned.
Did you like that style?
I did. I think it was pretty exciting. I think at the time I was 19, 20 when I started working at Apple. So it was very like, it was very cool to be like on the cutting edge of something. And it felt like we were doing something like super mysterious and rebellious.
Like, do you implement that at Apocalypse? Secrecy?
In a way, we're big on secrecy. I'm big on not really talking about what we're doing. Like, if we're getting ready to launch a new project or whatever, we don't talk about it too much, like, unless you need to be in that inner circle until it's getting ready to come out. We hint at things, we talk about some things, but we don't really announce until we're ready to like make sure it's as close to what we want it to be as possible.
Wow.
Yeah. So he introduced that to me, and that he really started shaping my style of leadership. One of my styles of leadership, I think one of the aspects of my style of leadership today. I attribute a lot of like how I speak publicly and kind of how I lead my team was a lot of it started with Brian. Mm. And most of my career, I think, was shaped at Apple. I spent a lot of time at Apple. From Brian, I got adopted by another super incredible person named Arturo. He was my big mentor when I was at Apple. I moved over to the corporate side. I joined the marketing team. And when I grew with them, I got to meet this really awesome gentleman. And he was a former Nike exec and former NBA exec and did all these super cool things. And the really, really funny we were almost not supposed to connect. When he started there, Apple was really big on just like embracing your wild side, right? Like I remember going to Cupertino and before, you know, all the gender neutralism stuff that we have today was mainstream. Like that's the first place I saw like a guy walking around in a dress. And it was totally like, that's cool. That's just how we are here because it was California and it was super dope vibe. And so that was a really cool kind of kickoff into that culture. It was very rare in a corporate environment for people to show up in like flip flops and shorts. And I was huge on like, I was like, dude, if you guys are going to let us rock out with total freedom, like I'm going to own this. So I would come to work in slides every day and I was super comfortable. Obviously it got the job done, but I was just like, man, like, this is Apple. Like this is what we do. And so when he got ready to join the team, a lot of my managers at the time were like, bro, maybe like just for like a couple weeks, wear shoes, you know, like maybe just like be careful with. And I was always that guy at work that I'd show up in the morning with coffee for everybody and I'd always bring like snacks and stuff like that. And I probably spent a little too much time going around from desk to desk trying to get everybody together for lunch. Right. So I was kind of always like doing stuff that I definitely wasn't supposed to be doing. So whatever, when he got there, everybody was kind of like, yo, like, just lay low for a little bit. Just try to be cool. You know, we want this guy to have a good impression. He's a big deal. He's got all these, you know, act, whatever. And I was like, yeah, cool, whatever. So he shows up and he's walking around the office and I'll never forget. He had this really cool pair of Air Maxes on. And
you're a big shoes guy.
And I'm a big shoe guy, right? And he had worked at Nike. And so he was there walking around and everybody was kind of like around him. But at some point during the day, I think I was making coffee or I was getting coffee. And he went to go like make a copy of something and he just happened to be standing next to me. And I was like, hey man, just really want to compliment your Nikes. Like those are dope Air Maxes. And he's like, oh, like you like sneakers? And boom, instant friendship. Dude is amazing. And we kicked it for a long time. We hung out at Apple. I learned an incredible amount of things from him. He really pushed me and introduced another crazy style of leadership to me. His thing was he really wouldn't give a lot of guidance. It was a little scary in how he would present projects. I remember the first big project I did for him. We had a video. Apple had made a commercial that was like a stop motion video with a MacBook Air, and it had different stickers on it, and the stickers would rotate, and it was just like very quickly cool animation, right? But Apple was obviously spending millions of dollars on production and had entire studios. And one day he pulls me in his office and he's like, "Oh, you have experience with like film and production, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah, yeah." He's like, I want the Latin America version of this. And he shows me the video and I'm like, yeah, I mean, do we have like this? We have this, we have this. He's like, no. It's you, but just make it hot. And that was like his thing. Like any project he'd give you, just be like, make it hot. And off you go. And
so
good luck.
All this autonomy and creative agency. And
it was just like, do it and figure it out.
Wow.
And at first that was really annoying. And I was like, dude, like, I don't know what I'm doing. What do you mean? Like, what do you want? What stickers, whatever. But then you embrace it and you're like, nah, I'm going to make it hot. I'm going to do something that I'm going to be proud of doing. And I remember finally giving him that video and his reaction, like he's very big smile. He has a huge smile. And he was just like, oh, just like laughing. And then just to see how happy he got about it, that made me feel super dope.
Wow.
And I was like, yo, that's cool. Like I was allowed to do my own thing and it paid off in a really big way.
Wow.
And
that's
so
beautiful.
Yeah. So that's how I kind of got into the whole getting mentors. And those are some of the mentors that I had along the way. I still have many mentors that are guiding me today. You know, helping in when I switched over to hospitality from marketing.
Well, that's actually the question I was going to ask you, because it seems like you dove deep into corporate America. You were a banker and then you worked for Apple and, you know, you were on this track of being in this corporate world and seems like you were doing well. You were moving up in the world. How do you go from that to owning a restaurant and one of the hottest restaurants in Miami? For you who's listening, if you have not gone to Apocalypse to eat barbecue, you got to go to Apocalypse. And now we've got Lala's too.
Yep.
Which is my personal favorite because I love a good burger.
Okay.
So I love Lala's. How did you go from Apple and corporate work to owning a restaurant?
So the very short answer is first you get cancer and then you survive COVID. And that's how my entire life essentially shifted through two major catastrophic events.
Okay. So we can't just leave that at that, right?
Okay.
Tell me about cancer.
So When I was with Apple, I got diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia.
And how old were you?
At this point, I was about 24.
And so you'd been at Apple for how long?
I was with Apple for about, I started with Apple when I was 18. So about 6 years, 7 years.
Wow. So from 18, and then you're 24 years old and you get hit with cancer.
Yeah. This is pretty wild. Had a cold. I was in a really interesting chapter of my life. I think I was, at the time I thought I was at the peak of my life. I was a power lifter. I was at the gym every day. I thought healthy as an ox, just doing all kinds of really crazy stuff. And I got a cold that just would not go away. And I had this cough that just, it was hammering me. And I went to go see my doctor after 1,000 people told me, like, go get yourself checked. I finally caved in and I went. And my doctor was like, okay, I'm going to prescribe this different cough medication for you, whatever. Here's this. And so as I'm getting ready to leave the appointment, he's like, by the way, like, you're past due for a yearly checkup. We should probably just do some blood work while you're here. And I was like, all right, cool. It was like a lab core thing or whatever. So he draws my blood and they send it off and off I go. And a couple of days later, I remember it was a Friday night and I was getting ready to go out. I was going to meet a buddy of mine and we were going to go party. We were going to Bougainvillea's and it's a fun spot, very fun spot.
Bougainvillea's, that's a blast from our past.
Yep.
Wow. I haven't heard that name in a long time.
So I'm getting ready to go to Boogie's and it's like 8 o'clock Friday night. I'm walking out the door and I get a call from my doctor, which I thought was weird. And I was like, maybe he wants to get a beer. I doubt it. Let's see. So I answer the phone and he's like, where are you right now? I'm like, I'm at home. He's like, I need you to come to the hospital. And I'm like, what? He's like, I just need you to come to the hospital. This is weird. It doesn't make any sense. I think we made a mistake on the blood test. I need to check you right now. I'm like, okay, whatever. And so I'm head over to the hospital and I'm waiting and they run a bunch of blood tests and the results come back and they're like, this is not a mistake. You're in a really bad situation. You have almost no white blood cells. I think if I remember correctly, you're supposed to have between 3.5 to 10 or 12 is like the range of white blood cells per unit. I had like 0.2. My hemoglobin was at a 4 or like a 2 also. It was super low. My platelets were like non-existent. And basically he was like, man, if somebody coughs on you, you're going to die. And I was like, okay, wait, what? Like, what do you mean? Like, super crazy. And they start throwing out all kinds of things. Like, they tell me, are you HIV positive? And like asking me all these crazy questions, like your immune system's wrecked. And so they're like, you can't leave the hospital. You have to spend the night. And we have to keep testing you. We have to figure out what's going on. And so I ended up spending 2 weeks at Mercy. And they tested. And finally, everything came back negative. They started testing me for like weird diseases that only existed on the other side of the world. And like none of that stuff panned out. And finally, they were like, the only thing that's left is leukemia. Like, we need to do a bone marrow biopsy. And so they did it, and it came back with AML. And that's how I got diagnosed. Wow. And so I was...
24 years old is rough. Young to have cancer.
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. And it was a weird thing because the doctors were like, you know, generally this kind of illness, you either get it when you're a baby, like a child. It's very, very common in pediatric cancer. Very common in with older folks, right? But it's not very common with adults your age. And so it was very strange for them and obviously very strange for me. It was a very crazy thing to be told, like, you know, you have this disease. And I was kind of like, I was a little pissed because, you know, I'm 24 and I'm my career is growing. I'm like moving up the ladder at Apple and that's something I'm super proud of. And, you know, I had just gotten my own place and like all these things were happening in my life. And I was like, dude, this is awesome. Like, I can't get sick now. This is crazy. And so I ended up going to the hospital.
And then you learned the principle of welcome to, you don't have a choice right now. You don't get to decide. You don't get to decide when the universe throws you a curveball.
Yeah. Yeah. Life is going to just do what it's going to do. Life's right. So went to the hospital. I went through treatment and they were like, listen, the only way that we can really cure this thing is if you get a bone marrow transplant. And so we're going to try to find a match. But because you're Latino and just different cultures, it becomes the more diverse your background is, the harder it is to find a match. And with Latinos, it becomes extremely difficult to find one. And so we looked for a year while I did treatment and they were not able to find me one. So I went into remission. And that was a good thing, but there was always a big question mark on like, are you going to stay in remission or are you going to relapse? And so I went back to work and lived my life really, really awesome for a year. I went to Israel, went on a cool trip.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
How did your perspective about life change? Because you said that you were pissed for a while. Did you stay pissed or did you change? Like, what happened in that process?
I was very upset in the beginning when I first got diagnosed. And then as time went on, it was less about being upset and more about being appreciative. And you start to think of all the times that you were taking for advantage, right? That you took for granted. And I think the biggest kind of in your face moments about that was you spend a lot of time in the cancer ward and you meet someone and they're super cool. And you're like looking forward to hanging out with them because friends don't happen often, right? And you're having coffee one day and then the next day you wake up and you're like, oh, I'm going to get coffee with my boy. And your boy passed away in the middle of the night. And you're like, wow. Yo, that's wild. And so to come face to face with that time and time again, you really learn like you don't have tomorrow. It's not promised to anybody. You have today, you have this moment. And so you gain a massive appreciation for it. You know, the actual going through the experience the first time that I did it wasn't the worst thing that I've ever had to endure. The second time was a lot worse. But the appreciation for life, you know, I thought when I got diagnosed, I thought I was invincible. I was walking around, saw the 250-pound dude, like strapped. I was competing in powerlifting. I was not into relationships at the time. I had a lot of different girlfriends, but none very serious. And just like everything was going my way. I was like, yo, life is, I'm on top of the world. Mm-hmm. I never thought that something was going to happen to knock me down. And so I got humbled very quickly. And I learned that you have to be grateful for everything that you have, because you don't know when it's going to be gone.
So you said that you were in remission and then you said the second time was worse. So I'm assuming that
I didn't stay in remission. No. A year later, I found out things were a little weird and I found out that my cancer had come back. And so I went back to the hospital and they said, listen, you know, if I were to put it to you, I guess to kind of add some perspective, the first time I went through cancer, I spent 90% of my time playing Xbox and like hanging out with my friends. So many of my friends would come visit me that they ended up moving me to like a special room that they usually only reserve for like international guests. That's a much bigger room because we were always having like hangouts. Like it was just always people were there. And it was, you know, I look back on those years and I was like, oh, it wasn't that bad. Like it sucked, but it wasn't terrible. The second time was not that.
Why?
And they were like, yo, man, we're going to have to be a lot more aggressive. And so the medications that they were giving me the second time around really did a number on me and had left permanent damage on my body. I was out. I don't remember this, but a buddy of mine, Gabe, would always tell me how one time he came to visit me in the hospital and he's like, bro, this is the last time I'm going to see him. Cause I was like slumped over my bed, just like kind of, I couldn't move. And he's like, you got lucky that I came, because he was there with another guy, Bodie. And as I was kind of like falling off the bed and the nurse couldn't get me up and they had to like push me and lift me into the bed. And I wasn't responsive to anything. And I wasn't doing good. The treatment was rough. It was bad.
Were you terminal?
With leukemia, it's a little weird. They don't tell you like you're terminal, because it's not like stage one, stage two. Like doesn't have the same stages as other cancers, because other cancers are based on like the stages are kind of based on spread. Leukemia is all over your body because it's a blood cancer. So there was a good chance that I wasn't going to make it. There's a better chance that I wasn't going to make it the second time around. But that wasn't something that we ever really focused on. It's not something we talked about a lot. I just kind of left that. That wasn't an option for me because I wasn't checking out anytime soon. So
you were like, I'm going to fight for this.
That was without a doubt always in the forefront of my mind. Like I'm going to get through and I'm going to win. And there is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Like this has to happen.
Something that I often ask my community is, what is saving your life right now? And I ask that question because we're very quick to say, like, what's killing me? Like, oh, you know, this job is killing me, or this relationship is killing me, or this traffic is killing me. But we don't often say, what's saving me? And as you're saying this, in a situation where you had literally something killing you, what saved you?
A big part of it was my family. And a big part of it was when I got diagnosed the first time, I, in a weird way, found an opportunity in that we often talk about, or we fail to talk about how strong our potential is. And we fail to focus on the things that we can do. And I wanted to show people very early on when I went through what I went through that cancer is not this monster that lives like that can take over your life. It is a monster, but we can shine a light on the monster and we can fight it back. And so it was really important to be transparent. Like I was very early on before social media craziness took over, I was on Instagram. Like I told all my friends and family, like, yo, I got diagnosed with leukemia. Don't worry, I'm going to win. And I would document, like I have pictures of like when I was getting drilled for a bone marrow biopsy, or I would post pictures of like hearing chemotherapy again. And my mindset was, you know, we have this incredible potential in our hearts and our souls and our minds. And when you look at athletes, I looked a lot at Ray Lewis when he was chasing the Super Bowl with the Ravens at the time. And this guy was just driving these people forward with his will. Like he pushed that team to win a Super Bowl with his will. And I was like, dude, if he's going to win a Super Bowl, I'm going to be cancer. And then I started thinking about like, yo, if he can do it, like look at what LeBron James can do. Look at what all these Michael Jordan, every incredible athlete that's ever existed, what do they have that we don't? They have the same 24 hours, right? They have access to all the same foods that exist in the world. Like we're all on the same playing field. They're just committed to one thing and they don't let anything waver that. And I was like, I'm going to commit myself to this one thing, not just for me, but so that everybody that's watching me, everybody that knows me knows that if they commit to something, they can do the same. And so that was kind of the big push, because if I failed and if I died, then I was telling everyone else, like, it's not going to work out. And so that became my responsibility to myself and to my people. And that was what kept me alive.
Well, that sounds like it gave you a lot of purpose, right? Yeah. And I'm hearing you had been in a situation where you were at Apple and learning from these role models and studying core competencies and leadership tools, and how we do one thing affects how we do other things. And I wonder if that was a moment for you to step into leadership, where you were like, I am going to be the leader of this movement against cancer for myself.
Yeah.
So it's a cool thing to watch, to see that, like subconsciously, you know, it's important. It's always important to connect the dots. I always say like, you're always in training for something bigger.
I love that.
Yeah. It's cool to see how, I don't know, just listening to your story at 13 or 14 years old, you are learning about SEO and you're learning about marketing really, and about, you know, putting up a website. And then now you're at Apple and you're learning about leadership and you're learning about core competencies and ambiguity and living in uncertainty and vagueness and mystery. And then here you are with this uncertain cancer and you are documenting the journey. You're living in the mystery. You're refusing to quit. You're becoming a leader. You're showing up for your community and saying like, I'm not going to go down. I mean, look at that connection.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. When you look back, you can really connect the dots. It's wild.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So then did you ever get the bone marrow transplant?
I did.
You know, I actually have a friend and client of mine who also had a bone marrow transplant when she was very young. And she came to me because she had this desire to create a nonprofit organization in which she supports people who need bone marrow transplants.
How cool.
And she just launched about a year ago.
Amazing.
So I'm going to connect you with her.
That'd be awesome. We'd love to support in any way.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's something that we don't realize how much of a need there is for. So I learned while I was going through cancer that bone marrow transplants and blood transfusions are two things that we desperately need in this world and don't always have. Mm-hmm. So blood transfusions were a lifeline for me. I remember one day my red blood cells had gotten so low that I was in bed and I wanted to drink a cup of water, and I had a bottle of water and I couldn't open the cap because there's no oxygen flowing in my muscles and I was just exhausted. Wow. And so I was, and they were waiting for a bag of blood to come in and they couldn't find any. And so I was just in this hospital bed. And that was one of the times that we thought like, ooh, this is looking a little spicy. And we were waiting and we were waiting and we were waiting. And then finally they found blood in like Orlando or something, and they had to like fly it down. And it was just this crazy mission. And so when I left, I partnered up with One Blood a few times, and wow, I would do these blood drives, because what people don't realize is a lot of times when a catastrophe happens, everybody's like, I'll donate blood. Like, I'm going to go do it. Problem is, blood expires in like 3 or 4 days. It's very
right.
quick.
Right.
So it's not like they're saving that blood and like putting it somewhere and you can use it. So it's great for that catastrophe, but we don't think about the fact that in life, 1 out of every 3 people that you know is going to need a blood transfusion. And it's not always because of a catastrophe. It's a woman that's giving birth and loses a lot of blood during that process. It's a person that has a car accident that loses a lot of blood in the accident. There's so many everyday things that happen that yeah. result in people needing this, and they just don't get it. And the same thing with bone marrow transplants, right? Like, bone marrow is so difficult to get because not enough people register. And so when you have someone that's in a situation that needs that, it's very difficult to come across a match. There's 10 categories that you have to check. 7 out of those 10 have to at least minimal. And that's considered like a C, right? A, B, C, D, F. Like, that's considered like a C. Like, you ideally want like 9 out of 10. And it's so hard to find that for people. Mine was a 7 out of 10. When we finally found someone, it was like the least acceptable qualified or whatever.
But it saved your life.
It did. It did. It was insane. And I think it did really good because I remember there was another person that had gone through a bone marrow transplant right around the same time as me. And we would kind of compare eye to eye on like, how's he doing versus how am I doing? And I was walking and doing things and moving a lot quicker. Not that it's a race or anything like that, but just it kind of goes to show you that some people respond differently to that. And I don't know if it has to do with the criteria or stuff, but that person who donated that bone marrow was exactly the angel I needed because I was able to come out of that and keep living.
Yeah.
Wow. It's pretty cool.
So I know that we just recently celebrated your 10-year anniversary.
Yes.
Since you beat cancer.
Yes.
You said that what got you to Apocalypse was beating cancer and COVID.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about, so now you've beat cancer, you're 26 years old, and then COVID hits, and how does that change your life?
So in all the excitement, I guess we missed an important part of how the cancer caused Apocalypse to happen.
Yeah.
And so what happened was, because I was immunocompromised, I couldn't go out to eat anymore. That was one of the first things they told me, like, you cannot go to restaurants. And I am a true fat boy for life, and I love to eat. And I was like, there's no way that I'm not doing this. And I love barbecue. It's always been one of my favorite foods. My dad is Argentine. My mom is Brazilian. So churrasco and asado, like, all of those things were big in my life. And then when I was young, my friends introduced me to this place you've probably never heard of. It's called Flanagan's. And they had ribs that were just at the moment amazing. And so I fell in love and I started hunting barbecue everywhere I could go. And I would travel and I would do everything I could. And so my doctor's like, yeah, you're not going out to eat anymore. And I was like, wow, okay. Well, I'm not going to die without eating barbecue. So I know that's on the table. So what am I going to do? So I bought a smoker, a little Weber Smoky Mountain. I had no idea what I was doing. And I started making barbecue in my backyard. And so cancer was what was the catalyst for me learning how to barbecue. And then,
you're always in training for something bigger.
Right? Right. And so that was when I started, it became the thing. You know, people would come over as I beat the sickness, you know, birthdays continued to happen, football games continued to happen. Whatever we were celebrating, usually I was smoking ribs or doing something, right? Making whatever dish I could make. And I ended up cooking a lot, which for me was awesome. Like, I loved, you know, being the dude on the grill, and like, you really feel like you're king when you're cooking for your whole family and your friends and everybody. And it was just such a good feeling to be able to do that and to feed so many people. And it kind of took a life of its own, and it started growing and started growing and started growing. And then eventually I met this beautiful woman that is now going to be the mother of my child. Her name is Laura.
And when we say the mother of your child, you mean like, tomorrow could be the day.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed for tomorrow.
We are hoping that tomorrow that baby comes. But
so, yeah. but when I met Laura, we started dating, and she did not like me barbecuing at all. She was very against it. She was like, her reasoning was, I would put together these shindigs and everybody would come over, and she's like, you're outside all day. First of all, I don't hang out with you, which sucks, right? I'm entertaining everybody except for you. And then you come in the house, you stink, like, you smell terrible, that everything is dirty, the house is filthy, and it's just like, I don't like it. I hate it. So this cool thing happened where, like, the more love I got for Laura, the less barbecuing happened. And so whatever, I mean, it's cool, right? We make sacrifices for the people we love. And so I'm just going to take a moment to highlight, in case Laura's watching, I've been sacrificing for you from the beginning. So I focused on my business. I had left Apple at the time. After the second time I got sick, when I came back, I felt like something was missing in my soul. And that I thought I had found that when I started with Apple, and I thought I was going in that direction. But when I came back, I wasn't feeling it anymore. And I wanted to do more. And what I wanted to do, the reason I fell in love with marketing was because I've always wanted to help people tell their stories. Mm. And I always wanted little mom and pop shops, little small businesses to be able to tell theirs. And I knew that they didn't have the millions of dollars in marketing budget that all these other big companies had. But I knew that it shouldn't be that inaccessible. Like, everybody should be able to come out, especially with social media was rising. Like, we should be able to talk and learn about the people that are serving our community. And so I created an agency called Creative Seven, and I focused on mom and pops, small businesses that needed to have their stories told. And that's what I did. And I started doing a lot of really cool work. I helped a lot of really cool brands kind of establish their presence on social media and go out there and do exactly that, tell their stories. And we did that until 2020, 2019. And then COVID happened. And so the world kind of came to the screeching halt, and my business had just started coming up. And then started getting all these calls like, listen, dude, you know, we love you. We love the work, but we don't know what's going on in the world right now. And we got to pause, and there's no this and there's no that. And one by one, I lost clients until eventually I had no clients. And so I was home, and my wife is a nurse. So she was front lines, and she was in the mix of it. And that was
hard for her.
It was very brutal. Hard for her. It was very brutal. She was working 12, 14 hour days. You know, she'd send us pictures of, like, in our family chat, she'd be like, this is what I'm wearing today. And it was like this crazy outfits. And she was going into these rooms right in the beginning of it, when we had no idea what, like, people were, all you would hear was, you know, 50,000 people died in New York today, 100,000 people died, or this week, or whatever. And it was just like, death, death, death. And then here's my very petite, you know, tiny little girlfriend at the time, before she became my fiance, just walking into this room, literally face to face with something that could kill her. And that was terrifying. Wow. And so the byproduct of her working and me not working, one is obviously she's doing all the stuff and she can't get home, and she's putting in so many hours. Like, she's not cooking. She's not, you know, I cook most of the time anyways, but whatever. She's not being able to run her errands or any of the things that she needed to get done. And so my new job became Laura's errand boy. Mm-hmm. And that was not fun.
We compensate wherever we have to, right? Listen, like, that's part of love.
Yeah, yeah. We do what we got to do, right? That was my way of kind of picking up the slack. I wasn't working, so what was I going to say? Like, of course I'm going to do that. And one day, we had just moved into our new house. We bought a home in February, and I was sitting there, and I had like a little office in the home, and there was a glass door that looked into our backyard, and that's where I had kind of put all my grills. I had kept all my grills, and they were there. And I had this idea, and I was just like, dude, you know, Laura's working all day. Like, what if I just make her some ribs? Who's going to be mad at barbecue? You get home, like, I'll clean everything up before she walks in. It's going to be great. And so, like, that was going through my head. And I had really had this desire to start barbecuing, and I had all this time now, right? Like, my business had kind of slowed down and or had kind of ended. And so I was just waiting to see what I could do. You know, that was cool to be able to step in and fill those roles, right? My business had gone down, and I was just doing what I could to support. But being an errand boy is not the funnest thing. And so I was dreaming about making some ribs and you know, just making some good food. And she calls me one day, and she's like, hey, it's a box. I need you to take it to FedEx. And I was like, okay, I got you, baby. Anything you need. And I walk outside, and I was just like, bro, I'm so tired of this apocalypse. Like, I just need this to end. And then it fucking hit me. And I was like, apocalypse barbecue. And I dropped the box, and I went full marketer mode. I went inside my house. I got on, made an Instagram, made a Facebook, started calling all my friends. Like, yo, you've had my barbecue. You know, it's good. Go repost this right now. And I was like, yo, I'm going to sell ribs outside of the house. And I called Laura, and I told her my idea. And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, I'm on the way to the grocery store right now. I'm going to Publix. I'm buying ribs. This is what's happening. I'm selling this weekend. Bye. And so I did it, and I had no idea what I was doing. Lit up a smoker, started selling ribs, did not charge anywhere near what I was supposed to be charging, like, whatever, but I did it. And first couple of weeks, you know, we sold a couple ribs. It wasn't anything crazy, but I was like, yo, listen, like, even if we don't sell the ribs, I have ribs to eat. So I'm winning. Like, it's just, I'm good. Like, if it's covering the cost of me having barbecue, I'm having free barbecue. This is amazing. And then, you know, 2 became 4, and 4 became 6, and 6 became 8, and 8 became 16, and then 20, and then 40, and then 100. And then things just started to grow. And one day, somewhere in the mix, you know, my mother-in-law, and first Laura was like, at first she was very adverse to this. She's like, this is not happening.
You know, I have the biggest question ever, right?
What's that?
how did you bridge the gap from this woman who does not like the smell of barbecue or having you cooking to actually devoting your entire life and career to ribs? How do we bridge that gap here, everybody?
I think
because there's going to be wives here that are going to be like, how did he get away with it? And there's going to be guys who are going to be like, how do I go back to my passion?
So I think early on, Laura realized that when I want to do something, I'm going to do it. So I really do think her original mindset was like, maybe if I just facilitate this long enough, he'll just, you know, like a lot of times I start stuff and I get into it for a little while and then I'm just like, okay, I'm done. This is enough. And I think she thought that this was going to fizzle out. And she's like, you know, I'll just let him have his fun. It'll be whatever. And then in a couple of weeks, like, I don't have to worry about this anymore. And then she started kind of seeing it and she's like, I don't know what came over her. I think she just wanted to be a part of it in some capacity. And she's like, dude, you need a side. Like, you need something. Like, you can't just sew ribs. And I'm like, all right, well, what should I do? She's like, I'm going to make cornbread. And I'm like, what? She's like, I'm going to make cornbread. And so she started making cornbread. And then her mother got involved. And then her mom was like, no, but you need a dessert. And her mom had this like incredible cookie recipe that I to this day say is the reason that I married Laura. If it wasn't for those cookies, I probably wouldn't have been with her.
Are those the cookies that you keep bringing into my house to tempt me from trying to eat healthy?
Yes. Aren't they amazing?
They're so amazing.
And they're filled with love, right?
Oh, so my God.
Those cookies are probably the reason I'm married to Laura. And she jumped into the kitchen and then she started making cookies. And then just these three people that had absolutely no business making food and selling it to the public, making cornbread cookies and ribs. And it became huge. And one day we opened up our door and the cul-de-sac was like slammed. And we're sitting there looking at each other and we're like, whoa. This is crazy.
But what do you mean the cul-de-sac was slammed? What do you like?
It was just all out of my house. We're doing
so
this.
So you open the door to your house and you have like a line outside.
Yes.
Your house?
It was just a mass like amount
of
people.
This is a legit story.
Yeah. Like legit people are just waiting to get their barbecue, right? Because they would. So the way we did it is you would put your orders in.
And this
the
is
week.
During COVID.
This is during COVID. So it also made a lot of sense because barbecue has always been about bringing people together. You never go to a barbecue restaurant by yourself. I mean, very rarely, unless you're an animal like me. But usually you're bringing your friends, your family, your cousins, whatever. Everybody's coming together to be able to enjoy a pretty big meal. Barbecue is Thanksgiving food. Like, let's be honest.
Right.
Right. So it's feast food. And so in this time when everybody in the world was being told, you need to be separated, you need to pay apart, you need to have social distancing, this kind of became a really cool way to find a way to bring everybody together, right? You were buying barbecue, going to a park somewhere, opening up a blanket, and yo, you were reconnecting in a way that we haven't connected in decades, right? Like all of a sudden, this time frame allowed us to stop and go back to family dinners. And so it made a lot of sense. Like, I don't know. To me, it was like, this is how I wasn't saving the world in any kind of, I'm not trying to like make this grander than what it is, but it was my way of helping save my community, right? It was like, how do we hold us together? How does everybody hold each other's hands when we can't hold each other's hands? And food is what did that.
And of course, I have to connect the dot. You went from having this creative agency where you told mom and pop stories to telling your own story.
Yes. Yeah.
You just started telling your own story.
Yeah. It was really cool to be able to do that. And we told
he had all this training
little by little, right? Life sets you up.
Life sets you up.
And I honestly think about that often. And I'm just like, man, if I didn't do this, would this exist today? Like, would I be here right now? I don't know.
Well, I often say that life is rigged in your favor and that it is your responsibility to show up to your life as if it is rigged in your favor, even when you don't like the outcome.
I love that.
And that's the most important part because it's easy to say life is rigged in your favor when you are 19, up and coming at Apple with mentors and bodybuilding and, you know, dating a bunch of girls and you're on easy street. It's much harder when you are fighting in a hospital room with cancer, you know, limb and having no ability to get a bone marrow transplant for over a year and you have people coming to see you and you don't know if you're going to make it or not. It's hard to say life is rigged in your favor there, but that doesn't happen and you are not the owner of Apocalypse today.
Right.
Right? Like this is, it's just, this was your path and your journey. And I think you know, one of the things that you talked about was beating cancer made you confront your potential. If LeBron James and Ray Lewis can pull this kind of achievement with athleticism, how am I not going to be able to do it with cancer?
Right.
So I wonder if that is what was the impetus for you. By the time that you had this apocalypse idea, meeting that potential is peanuts compared to fighting cancer.
I think in a weird way, cancer was my COVID before COVID. Right. I also think about a lot of the leukemia protocols were COVID protocols, right? At the time I had to wear a mask because I couldn't be exposed to people that were sick. I had to wash my hands 100 times. It's like all these, like, I couldn't be around a ton of people. I had my own social distancing. I had all the things that we had kind of been told that we have to do during COVID. I had all of that years prior. So you were talking about how things set you up for the future, right?
Yeah, and you're always in training.
I think that was my training. It was almost like someone up there was like, I'm going to need you to be able to do something really dope in like a few years. So you got to know what's coming to kind of set that up and be ready for that. Man, life trains you, right? It's crazy.
Well, and I also think you're willing to accept the challenge.
Yeah.
Because you could have been telling a different story. You could have been like, I got cancer and life sucks. And, you know, ever since then, I've just been, has sucked.
It's a big mindset thing, right? Like there's a phrase that gets thrown around a lot. Like when someone doesn't necessarily get something their way or they lose, right? They say, oh, I took an L, right? I took a loss. And I hate that phrase so much. And I talk to my team about it. And I'm like, yo, you're never taking a loss. Like you should be happy to take an L. Because you're taking lessons. Every single thing that we endure in life is either a success or a learning opportunity. There's Amen. Nothing else.
Amen.
There's nothing else.
There is nothing else. So you got these people outside your cul-de-sac.
So this is where it gets interesting, right? So we're like super stoked. The three of us, at the end of the day, we're exhausted. We're sitting back, we're looking at each other, and we're like, wow, this is so dope, right? Like, how amazing is this? And whatever, we're getting ready for next week. And then the next morning I wake up, and there's a knock on my door and there's a letter from the HOA and they say, no idea what you're doing, but stop.
Gotta love HOA. You know, I was an HOA lawyer.
Oh, really?
In 2008, it would have been me sending you that letter. Sucked.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. Well, we got it. We got it. And they were like, yo, can't do it anymore. You gotta stop what you're doing. And it was like, damn, dude. Like, and that was the first in the many, many mountains that we faced in apocalypse. That was the first challenge that we had. It was like, what do we do now? Because obviously we don't have a restaurant. We don't have money to open a restaurant. We don't have a commissary kitchen. We don't have a commercial kitchen. We have no licensing. We have no idea what we're doing. We have nothing that would be needed in order to be able to push this thing forward, right? And so we were frustrated. And that was kind of one of the first times where I learned that asking for help is the best thing that you can do. And so we kind of just threw it out into the universe. I just started asking questions to people like, here's my situation. What do I do? And there's this a friend of ours, her name is Nat. She kind of seemingly out of nowhere. And she was like, I know this really dope like beer spot in Wynwood and they're looking for someone to sell food. Like, why don't you hit them up? And I was like, okay, sure, whatever. And I went and I had a meeting with these guys at a spot called Box Elder. And I didn't know that Miami New Times had actually written an article about Box Elder and called them the food incubator of Miami, because places like El Bagel, House of Mac, United States Burger Service all had kind of popped up and done residencies at Box Elder and gone off to do amazing things in the hospitality scene of Miami. I had no idea. I just showed up because I needed a place to sell barbecue. And so I came and I sat down with Adam and his wife and they were like, dude, food's awesome. You seem like a cool guy. Don't burn the place down. Have fun. And so I started selling barbecue there on Sundays and it was just became this thing and it grew even more, right? We finally got like a real influencer to come by. Is this Donna from Miami Food Porn came by, did an article. And then when she did that, it was crazy. Now all of a sudden we had like these 4-hour lines and people are waiting to get barbecue. And, you know, it's just, it's me, my mother-in-law, my wife, and we had another guy named Alec that started helping us. And it was just the four of us trying to like figure this whole thing that's growing out. And so we had an idea. I was like, dude, I can't make barbecue every day because it's just me. At the time, I was cooking all night. So I would, you know, if we were serving food on Saturday, on Wednesday, I'd go shopping for all the meats and stuff that we needed. On Thursday, I was trimming and cleaning and prepping and seasoning and doing everything we needed to do. Friday morning, I started smoking. I was cooking all night. And then Saturday morning, I would finish cooking, load up my, I had a Jeep Wrangler at the time. I would hook up my little trailer to the Jeep, and I was driving straight to Box Elder, and I was showing up on fumes, like empty. And so I would, and then it was another 6 hours in the sun. We were outside in the streets, and we had a tent for where we did the POS, so to say. So my wife, she was underneath the tent, so she had some shade, but we were in the sun just cutting barbecue all day. And
did you ever want to quit?
I'm not going to say the idea never creeped through the back of my mind, but I think I realized very early on that there was no choice.
Why?
Because what was I going to go back to? Like, my marketing company had gone down. I kind of felt weird going backwards. I didn't want to go get a job again. Like, I knew what it was like to work for myself. And I knew that if I could make this work, like, I could do something really special. Mm. And so
the desire was too big of a pull.
Yeah. It was just like, I had to make this happen. And then when it really became no choice was, we were a few months into it. And we were in a really interesting stage where the brand was really cool and we were growing our popularity, but we weren't making any money. In nowhere in my pop-up phase did I ever make a dollar. I actually lost every single time I opened up my doors to sell barbecue. I lost money.
Okay, let me stop you right there real quick, just because that's such an important thing. Oftentimes we confuse popularity with dollar bills.
Yeah,
no, we think that because people are popular and they have a big, they're influencers or they have a big following, that they are, that there's revenue to back that. And we see that, we see the picture of success, and we really have no idea what the person is going through behind the door, behind the scenes. So I think it's a really important thing for somebody to know that you could be growing a brand, you could have such connections, you could be have a line out the door, and that you're not making any money.
Yeah.
That's people don't see that part.
It's a very real, unfortunate, difficult thing to navigate, but it's absolutely true. We were losing money every single time. We were actually losing so much money that it got to the point where one day I was looking at the bank account and I had to make a really difficult decision. And that was either I buy food to pop up the next week or I paid my mortgage. Wow. Both was not happening. It's not an option for
both.
Which
one did you choose?
So I got creative, and this is when I said, there really is no choice. So there's this phrase that I absolutely love, burn the ships. I'm sure you've heard it.
Yes, of course.
And so I had all my camera gear from when I did my marketing stuff. It was in my house. And there was a time when in my marketing, I did a lot of photography, and there was a time when my photography commanded a really nice premium. Like, I was doing really good in that industry. And I always knew, and I had told my wife this many times to comfort her, I was like, hey, listen, like, if we're in a bind, I can go do a photo shoot for, you know, whatever, one of the companies that I used to work. And I used to get paid like $1,500, $2,000 a day just to take pictures. And that was light work for me. I was like, I can do that. And so I'm like, it started hitting me in my head. I was like, I think I'm going to have to go do this. I'm going to have to go take a couple pictures on the side. And something inside of me was like, if you take one fucking picture, this is done. And I was like, okay, so what do I do? I packaged up all my gear. I went to this website called Adorama. I called the guy. It's a store in New York. I called the guy and I was like, I have all this camera equipment. How much can I get for it? And they made me a price. It was just enough to cover my mortgage. And so I bought food and I paid my mortgage for the month.
By selling your gear.
Yeah.
You burned the boats.
I burned the boats. Burned the ships. Have to. You have to. And that was really when there was no choice, because now I couldn't go back. I had invested so much money in the stuff that I had, like, to buy all that stuff again was not even close to the realm of reality.
So when was the pivot? Like, when is it that you started to see the light of day?
So at Box Elder, Miami Food Porn had come by and done the post, and we got really big. And so I was like, there's got to be a way that I can do this more than one day a week, because I'm too tired to do it just all in one shot, to do barbecue. And so I had this idea, like, well, what if we start doing burgers? Like, we do burgers one day and then we do barbecue another. Burgers are relatively easier to do. It's not an entire, I don't have to cook overnight. Like, I can do them on Wednesdays before I start doing all my stuff for the week, and I can figure it out, and I think I can make it happen. And so I started doing burgers, and it was really interesting because I made burgers in my house a million times, but I never made burgers for people waiting in line to eat burgers. And I had this little tiny grill that my wife had bought me for my birthday. It was a little flat top. And I could make like 8 to 10 burgers at a time.
That reminds me of my husband, because my husband has a little grill that we used to take everywhere. And I could see him making pancakes and burgers. And like that little grill, I could just see it.
Little grill is helpful. Little grill is helpful. And so we were rocking with that little grill. The good thing, the good problem that we had at the time was an insane amount of people were coming to get burgers. And so we actually had people that were waiting in line almost 2 hours to order a burger. And then they had to wait another hour to 2 hours for me to make their burger, because I could only do like 8 at a time. So it was this horrible bottleneck, right? We were trying to get these burgers. And I mean, we were working it. Like, we were doing everything we could, but it wasn't a commercial grill. So you throw your burgers on there. And then once it was done cooking, the grill had cooled off. So you had to give it a little bit of time to heat back up so you could get the right sear on the burger. And it was just, the grill was destroying us. And there was this guy, he kept coming. And one day he was there, he was waiting for his burger. He'd come a lot. And one day he's like kind of just hanging out just by the front. And while we're cooking or whatever, he's waiting for his burger. He's trying to kill his time. And he's like, bro, like, why haven't you guys opened a restaurant? And I don't know where it came from, but like something inside of me was like, make this joke. And I looked at him and I'm like, yeah, man, I'm just waiting for you to cut me a check, like 250 grand. And you know, we make it happen. And he looks at me and he's like, ha ha. Takes his bag, gets in his car and leaves. And I was like, whatever, just keep cooking. We'll keep going through the day. We're breaking down that night and everything's kind of, we're putting everything away. And I go look at my phone and I have a DM from this dude. And he's like, yo, if you're serious, I have a check for you.
No.
Yeah.
You're freaking kidding me.
No, that's how I met my business partner. It's crazy. He took the biggest gamble. I mean, food is not a safe bet. Like, anybody will tell you, don't invest in a restaurant. I think investing in a restaurant that's not even a restaurant, that's like a little pop-up on the side of the road with some guy that has no idea what he's doing, probably the biggest gamble you could make in your life. And he saw the potential, and I think he just saw something crazy. And he did it. And he wrote our first check. And that was honestly, that probably happened. I think that was very close to when I was like, man, if I can't figure out a way to turn this around and like actually make some money, I'm going to have to throw in the towel. Like, I couldn't keep dragging my wife into something that, you know, we're in a situation where I can't financially support our family, right? Like, it's just something has got to give. And this thing is awesome and it's fun and it was cool and it was moving in the right way, but it was adding very real stress to our very real lives, right? Like, how do we pay bills and how do we do this and how do we do that? And so there was a lot of challenges. And
I mean, my heart is beating out my chest with that story.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was really
wild. That is insane.
Yeah, it was crazy. And he showed up and, you know, we sat down and we figured out a partnership agreement and we hung out a lot. I'm also, you know.
And you didn't know this guy.
At all.
He wasn't your friend.
At all. Not someone that was in my circle. Like, now he's someone that I love tremendously, right? Like, I feel like he's a part of my family. He's definitely a part of my family.
I can imagine. Like, I would think he is. Yeah.
But yeah. And also, you know, funny, I never dawned on this, never really clicked for me right now, but until you said this, but he's actually the reason I got into watches. And so in a way, he's the reason I'm friends with your husband.
Oh, it's my God. Crazy. You know, and when you said the story, I thought, so my husband is the kind of person that, very much like what you just described, he'll throw something out there, like he'll say something. So I remember there was one random day he was here and he said, you know, this was before he got like into watches, but he said to me, he's a criminal defense attorney. And he said, can you imagine if I, like, you know, somebody came to my office and I could, you know, instead of getting X amount of money, I could just get this watch. And he like named a watch. I can't remember the watch, what it was at the time, but it was like a watch that he liked. He was like, can you imagine if I could just get that in fees? And he said that offhandedly. And then like a week later, he comes home and he's like, look at this. Because he was in his office and a guy came in with the watch he had told me about. And he was getting quoted a fee. And he said, well, it's this amount of money, or you could give me that watch you have on your wrist, jokingly. And the guy took the watch off and was like, here you go. I'll bring you the box and papers tomorrow.
Oh.
True story.
I need to find a catering deal like that. That's crazy.
Yes, yes. And I'm thinking about it. I'm like, how many times for anyone who is listening, do you have a thought in your mind that you're like, you have a thought, but you never actually say it?
Yeah.
What if you actually just said it? There. Like, what if you just put it out into the universe and just said, if you do this, or if you say this, or you ask the question, or you ask for the help, or you just put out the possibility and you don't self-select yourself out of that possibility. Yeah. What a crazy thing.
Something we talked about mentors, something Arturo used to say to me all the time was, if you put it out into the universe will conspire to make it happen. Mm. And it's insane how many times that for me in my life has checked out, right? Like I can very confidently tell you that 99% of the things, if not maybe 100% of the things that I do, I start off having no idea what I'm doing. And I just know they need to get done. I'm like, we need to figure out this solution. And somewhere along the way, we figure it out, right? Like, so I always use the analogy, like, we know we need to fly, but we don't have an airplane. So let's just get in the sky and build the airplane while we're mid-trip.
That's like, right.
So we have
to build that plane while it's flying. Yeah,
build the plane while it's flying.
And just not being willing to give up. That is incredible. That is incredible that you are willing to build that plane while you're flying. And would you say that you were born innately with this gift of like figuring it out? Or would you say that your life has trained you to become the kind of person who figures it out?
Well, it's such a tough question. I think if I had to say that I have a purpose in my life, I definitely would say that I'm living that purpose. But I think the reason I'm able to do it the way I do it is because of the experiences that I've had along the way. Mm. And the universe conspires to make things happen. Mm. And I think I was put in the situations that I was put in to be given the tools and resources to make it happen. Mm. And I think a lot about, you said it many, many times. And I'll never forget, there was a speech by Steve that really, really ties into what you said along the way, which is, you can only connect the dots looking back.
That's it.
And so
in hindsight.
Yeah. And so when I look back, it's just the puzzle pieces are too perfect. They fit together just a little too well for this not to have been what it was meant to build.
Mm. You said that if you had a purpose, and I actually have very strong feelings about purpose. I have a lot of conversations with people in my work about purpose. And my clients often come to me because they feel like they have no purpose, or because they feel like they've lost their purpose, when really what they've lost is their identity. But what I would say about purpose is, our job in our life is not to find purpose. Our job in our life is to live purposefully. Mm. Everything we do with purpose. Yeah. And what I see in you is that being so close to mortality, having cancer, understanding the fragility of your life has allowed you to be purposeful in whatever you're going to do, because you might not be here tomorrow.
Correct.
So
correct.
I think that that's more relevant of you having found your purpose than getting the download about apocalypse. Because you could have gotten the download about apocalypse, but if you did not have the purposefulness in your nature, you may have wasted that idea,
yeah,
or that gift. So I think that's really, really important.
It's a crazy way of looking at it. Yeah, but that's absolutely right. It's amazing.
Yeah. So I think the message for anyone is, if you are going to do anything in your life and you do it with purpose, knowing that you might not be here tomorrow, you don't have to wait until you have cancer.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait until it's almost over. Do it with purpose now.
Yes.
And life will conspire in your favor.
I agree with that. 1,000%.
Even when you don't like the outcome.
Even when you don't like the outcome.
Mm. So you are about to have a baby.
Yes.
How excited are you about beyond being excited. A first-time dad?
Beyond excited.
Okay. I have one question for you, and then I have two more questions for you, and then we're going to wrap it up. But this question is, now you have this business which you have so much purpose for, and you are building, and it's this big, huge thing, and you're growing massively. Now you have a second restaurant, and I know that there's more in your future. And you have this little baby on the way, and a family that you're building, and a wife to take care of. How, and yourself to take care of, right? Because your health has to be a priority. You've dealt with cancers. You know the importance of being healthy. how are you creating intentionality in your life to be able to manage all those puzzle pieces in a way that doesn't burn you out?
It's a very good question. And that's a very tricky, we're trying to figure that out. So my wife and I actually sat down recently and, you know, we came up with a plan and, you know, the old adage, right? There's a plan exists until you get punched in the face. Mm-hmm. And so there goes your plan. But whatever, we tried coming up with a plan and we're creating schedules and I'm trying to be very intentional about how I block my time, how I allocate my time. I think the most important thing that I can do, the best tool that I have right now, have a great team in Apocalypse, incredible people that are, and Lala's, right? At both of my restaurants, I have really, really great, passionate people that genuinely want to see this brand grow. They've bought into what we're doing and they believe in what we're doing. And so now it's about giving them keys to the kingdom and letting them run the show. And I have to delegate some of these tasks. And, you know, a lot of people talk to me and they're like, well, aren't you worried that things are going to change and things are going to dilute or whatever, whatever. And yes, I think that comes with the territory. But you have to understand something. There's only so much of myself that can exist. And at some point, we need to bring in new ideas, new vision, new blood, new viewpoints on everything that we're doing. And that's the only way we can continue to expand. I don't know that there's a limited amount of ideas in somebody's head. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't, right? But I think if there is, mine are pretty much getting close to the end. And I mean, even if there isn't, my bandwidth is moving in a completely different direction. Like I have a child now. And so I don't think we'd ever let the quality of what we do drop. I think we all believe in what we're doing. We all understand why we have to do things the way we do them. And when you have that and everybody rallies behind that, that consistency is going to continue to exist. Mm. We've spent a lot of time developing systems to maintain our standards. So now, you know, leaders don't manage people. They manage systems. Mm. They let people do what they need to do. And so within the parameters of what they've created, they're going to drive the business forward and put their fingerprints on the next chapter of what we do.
And my husband tells me that you are the best at that because you have brought all of your knowledge from Apple to be able to implement those systems and duplicate what you learned at Apple at Apocalypse, which I think is really fascinating also. I'd love to have a conversation about that, but we are almost out of time. So I'm going to ask you one more question.
Okay.
And that is, today, what is sparking bliss in your life?
Ellie.
Ellie. She's not even here yet.
I wasn't supposed to be a dad. One of the byproducts of the bone marrow transplant and everything I went through was I wasn't supposed to be able to have kids. And so when we found out that it happened naturally, I think it was the greatest news I could have ever have gotten. Mm-hmm. And I've spent every day today. I spent my entire morning this morning in a room just drinking coffee and just enjoying the fact that she's going to be here soon. And so, yeah, it's her 100%. Mm-hmm.
Not everybody appreciates fatherhood the way that you are appreciating it. That is a gift. And she's a very little lucky girl to have you as a dad and Lala as a mom.
She's more lucky to have Lala, right? I think Laura's the greatest thing that happened to either one of us. And she's very blessed to have her as a mom. But
we can't wait to meet her.
I definitely cannot. I'm counting down the seconds. I'm going to go home and make Laura hot sauce date milkshakes. I heard that might help.
Well, thank you for coming onto the podcast.
And thank you for having
this
me.
This has been an awesome conversation.
It has been. It's amazing.
Bye, Jeff.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks so much for being here. I am deeply, deeply grateful to connect. If you're loving this podcast, I'd love if you'd follow, rate, or leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Those reviews help us so, so much. And if you know of someone who could really use a voice like mine in their head, please share this episode with them. Now, if you're feeling called to keep the conversation going, come join us inside the Blissen Up community on Facebook. It is a free space to reflect and root into intention together. You can find the link in the show notes or just search Blissen Up with Caroline de Posada on Facebook. I'd love to welcome you in. Until next time, take care and keep noticing the sparks of bliss in your life.